Welcome to the Student Press Law Center podcast, a monthly rundown of news about legal developments affecting the student media. The Student Press Law Center is a nonprofit source of information and advocacy for the student media, and we work to break down the barriers that prevent college and high school journalists from doing their best work. For more information about the center, go to www.splc.org. I'm Frank Lamonti, Executive Director of the Student Press Law Center. Thanks for joining us. Well, if you follow media coverage of the juvenile courts and the juvenile justice system, one of the things you quickly notice is that with very rare exceptions, media reports withhold the names and faces of minors who are charged with crimes. This practice is so well established in the media that many people mistakenly believe it's the law and that media outlets can be punished if they identify juveniles by name or by face in their pages or on their broadcasts. In fact, the opposite is true. The Supreme Court has ruled that under the First Amendment, a state cannot make it a crime for the news media to broadcast truthful and accurate reports of juvenile proceedings. A recent court case decided in January 2011 by the Mississippi Supreme Court directly impacted the media's ability to gather and broadcast information about what goes on inside the juvenile justice system. The case involved WDAM-TV, an NBC affiliate serving the Hattiesburg, Mississippi area, which came into possession of some explosive video footage from security cameras inside a county juvenile detention center. WDAM faced a legal battle before they were able to air that footage for the public to see. And with us to discuss the case is one of the attorneys on their legal team, Enrique Armijo of the Washington, D.C. office of Covington and Burling, which is one of the nation's leading law firms for all types of media and communications law practice, among others. Mr. Armijo is a graduate of the University of North Carolina Chapel Hill School of Law. Before he joined Covington, he held a prestigious clerkship on the Federal Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit, and he also worked with the Program for Comparative Media Law and Policy at the University of Oxford. Mr. Armijo is also a former journalist and student broadcaster himself, and he worked for Florida's Palm Beach Post prior to law school, and he brings that hands-on media experience to his litigation and appellate practice at Covington. Well, we're going to turn to Mr. Armijo in just a second, but by way of setup, this case involves two very interesting legal and ethical issues that often confront people gathering news at student publications. The first of these is the legality of publishing or broadcasting information that about individual juvenile offenders. And the second is the issue of how a broadcaster or newspaper is supposed to respond if they are given material that one of their sources may or may not have obtained illegally. Enrique Armijo, thanks for being with us. And please, let's go ahead and start with a little factual setup about how the TV station got the story to begin with and then how it wound up in front of Judge McPhail in the Mississippi Youth Court.
Sure. Around the second week of December of last year, WDAM received video from a former Forest County Youth Center employee that showed abuse of juveniles detained in the youth center. WDAM then, its investigative reporter, began interviewing former juveniles that were shown on the tape and their parents, and all of whom agreed to appear on camera, and with the plan to run a story about the incidents that were shown on the video later that week. After the TV station contacted the Forest County Sheriff's Office, who administers the detention center, for comment, very shortly afterwards they received a call from the Sheriff's Office and the Prosecutor's Office of Forest County stating that they were in possession of embezzled property and that any identification of the juveniles on the video would violate the youth court proceeding statute of Mississippi, which generally bars people from identifying juveniles while they're in the system. The firm and I became involved in the case because Covington provides pre-publication advice to a number of TV stations owned by Raycom Media, of which WDAM is one, regarding all kinds of issues from libel review to advice regarding hidden camera investigations and other kinds of investigations, and a review of scripts and story ideas.
So there is a statute in Mississippi that applies to the privacy of juvenile records. Was it relevant to this case that the employee herself may have violated that statute, and would it matter for First Amendment purposes how the TV station came into possession of that footage?
Well, that's something that was actually litigated before the youth court. What happened was that once the youth court found out that the station had a copy of this video, they entered what's called an order granting injunctive relief, which basically said that WDAM or any other station could not air the video or describe what was on it. And the reason, one reason that the station couldn't do that was because of the statute that you're referring to, which basically said that records involving children could not be disclosed without the youth court's permission. Now, the station's argument was that the children weren't identifiable and that therefore this wasn't a youth court record. But more importantly, as you also mentioned, the Supreme Court of the United States has held in a case in 2001 called Bartnicki versus Vopper that the media, so long as the media acquires a material lawfully, so long as the media acquires video lawfully, it may air it regardless of how the third party who provided that material acquired it. So in other words, if the fact that this former employee may have violated this Mississippi statute regarding youth court records, that could not affect, as a First Amendment matter, could not affect WDAM's right to air it.
Right. I think that's a very important point that bears emphasizing, is that this perception that it is unlawful to disclose juvenile records may very well apply to people who work within the system, but constitutionally it cannot be applied to people in the news media as long as, under the Bartnicki case, right, they weren't directly involved in any kind of unlawful conduct themselves, like assisting in the theft of material or something of that nature.
That's right. It's basically irrelevant how the third party acquired the material that is later provided to the news media. And this actually has some interesting permutations that we're going to see in the very near future regarding WikiLeaks and things like
right.
that, as well as, you know, as well as a more conventional TV station and newspaper reporting as well. That it's an issue
right.
that comes up a lot.
Well, so the trial court, the youth court, enters an order invoking the state privacy statute and directs that the video not be aired. You then get the court you then get the case in front of the Mississippi Supreme Court, and several dozen media outlets and media organizations all got together and filed briefs in support of WDAM's case. Why do you think this case attracted that kind of national outpouring of support?
Well, I think it was first, it was the real breadth of the youth court's order. I mean, basically what the youth court said in its opinion was that the station had not presented evidence of a need for disclosure of the video, which always raises the hackles of journalists, because there are Supreme Court precedent that says editorial discretion has to be in the hands of the journalists and the editors and not the government. And also the breadth of the youth court order, which said that not only could WDAM not show the video, they also couldn't describe what was in the video. And the youth court also sought to enjoin any other media outlet. So in other words, basically companies that weren't before, media entities and companies that weren't before the youth court itself, were also barred from showing this video or describing it. So the fact that this was clearly what the media lawyers call a prior restraint, and also the fact that the youth court had basically said that every time a media outlet wanted to air information or print information and had to ask the youth court for permission to identify juveniles in the system, if in fact that's what that story would involve, I think is what really energized the media community and organizations that work on on First Amendment issues like the Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press and all the Mississippi associations of print journalists and broadcast journalists.
Right. So the case was able to get in front of the Mississippi Supreme Court on a very hurry-up basis, not the normal briefing schedule that we're accustomed to in the courts of appeals. And in a matter of weeks rather than months, the Mississippi Supreme Court enters an order in favor of the broadcasters and in favor of the First Amendment right to air this footage. Are you able to explain at all what their rationale was, or do you know what their rationale was?
It's hard to say, really, because they only entered a one-page order, which basically said our emergency petition for relief, which is what the station filed so as to be able to go directly to the Supreme Court, was granted. So it's difficult to know what their reasoning was, but I think a couple things are clear. One was that the youth court did not go through the three-part test that was required to show under Mississippi law in order to enter a prior restraint against a media company. And second, it was clear from the youth court's filings that it didn't have any intention to do so in future cases. In other words, the youth court's position was that any time someone wanted to show a video or write a story regarding a child, a juvenile that was in the system, rather, that they would have to go to the youth court first to ask for permission. So essentially what the youth court was asking the Mississippi Supreme Court to bless was a standing prior restraint. And I think the Mississippi Supreme Court, to its credit, understood that that was inconsistent with Mississippi and United States constitutional law.
So once this decision is handed down by the Mississippi Supreme Court, how did the station respond, and what has been the response and the fallout from their broadcasting?
Well, the Mississippi Supreme Court entered its order on January 27th. At about 3 o'clock, and as we said, it granted the station's petition for emergency relief. So basically, the youth court's decision barring the station from airing the video was vacated, and the station scrambled to get a story on the air that night using the video because of the station saw that it was an important story that needed to be told and that it needed to show the video in order to tell it. In terms of the reaction, it's just like any other controversial story. The viewer reaction is what it is. You know, some people support the station, support the station's right to show the video. I think it's important to show the video. Some people, whenever a station like this shows a video that's fairly graphic in nature, as this video was, showing juveniles and at the youth center, very violent interactions between juveniles of 16 years old and under, and some very large, very aggressive guards. Some viewers, were a little disturbed by that. And the beauty of the media business in 2011 is that there are a lot of ways for viewers to express their opinions about stories. Whether it's comments on the website, Facebook, what have you. So it's interesting to kind of track the reaction, the viewer reaction to the story once we actually aired the video.
Well, there are two ways to go about challenging a prior restraint, as you understand. One would be to do what the station did here, which is try to go before the courts and get the lower court's order vacated. The other would be just to defy the order, let someone try to bring an enforcement proceeding and appeal from that enforcement proceeding without compromising any of your confidential discussions with your client. Was that ever seriously considered, defy the order, broadcast right away, and see if the government comes after you? And what would you advise as a general matter as to which is the preferable strategy?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I mean, a lot of it was the reason we decided not to go the contempt route, which is what you described, which is so in other words, air the video despite the youth court order, be found in contempt of the youth court order, and then challenge that finding in the in the in the Mississippi Court of Appeals was that we thought that this was a faster way to be able to get the story on the air, going the emergency petition for relief route, but still remaining in compliance with the order. And it had a lot of, you know, the decision to not violate the youth court order, as you put it, which is the right way to put it, had a lot of interesting ramifications as well. I mean, this is a story that the station continued to tell, even though it was subject to this order. So, in other words, the station was running stories, talking about the incidents that occurred in the youth court center, in the detention center rather, but saying that it was subject to this injunction by the youth court that wasn't allowing it to tell the story in full. So the station did a lot of reporting all during the week that this matter was before the Supreme Court. But at the end of the day, we thought that the station it was both faster and less risky for the station to remain in compliance with the youth court order rather than go ahead and show the video despite the youth court order and be found in contempt.
Right. Well, and to be clear, as you described it, the station, even though the state probably could not constitutionally stop the station from airing the complete and unedited footage with the juveniles' faces visible, the station made the ethical determination that except for a few juveniles who agreed to actually be interviewed on air, they made the decision to blur and to obscure the faces on the security video, correct?
Well, that's right. They actually not only blurred the videos on the security video, they actually, even after the court entered its injunction, the station continued to blur the faces of the interviewees. So, in other words, even after these people were out of the juvenile justice system, arguably outside the youth court's jurisdiction, at least in the station's legal opinion, they continued to blur the faces of the interviewees, and that was probably the most difficult decision that the station made. There were a number of reasons for it, but mostly the main reason was that, again, the station decided that it wasn't in its interest to be found in contempt, so it read the order broadly, the part of the order that required it to not describe what occurred on the tape. It read that broadly to mean not to identify the juveniles on the tape, and it still to this day hasn't identified the juveniles on the tape, even through its interviews.
Well, just in the minute or two that we have left, do you think there are any lessons in this case for other journalists and specifically broadcasters about the use of leaked information such as this security footage?
I think there are. You know, it's the notions of, and you said this at the beginning, Frank, the idea of prior restraint is alive and well. And I think that one of the areas that may be overlooked is the youth court context. I mean, it's not uncommon for lawyers who practice and administrators, you know, public officials who are in the youth courts, to be basically barred from identifying juveniles. And the reason for that is the state doesn't want to place a scarlet letter on a person and a person who may have made a mistake as a juvenile. They don't want these experiences in the juvenile justice system to follow them as they go on into adulthood. So a number of states have the same kind of statute as Mississippi does, but where the youth court went wrong as a legal matter here was to try to apply that statute to a party that wasn't before the youth court, namely, obviously, the TV station. So I think that that media outlets, student newspapers, and others should be mindful of the fact that these types of statutes, confidentiality statutes, particularly as to juveniles, will always be read broadly by public officials and by people in the juvenile justice system. But the media outlets should remember, for the reasons that we talked about, that in nearly every case, it will be true that the outlet itself won't be barred based on a statute that binds people practicing for the youth court and the youth court itself.
Great. That's very, very useful and practical advice. And I want to thank you for being with us today, Enrique Armijo of Covington and Burling. And thanks for taking on this very important case that reaffirms the strong First Amendment right to gather and broadcast information about juvenile proceedings. For more information about your legal rights as a broadcaster, we hope that you'll use, enjoy, and share the resources on our website, www.splc.org. Please subscribe to the RSS feed for the SPLC's news alerts, become a fan of the Student Press Law Center on Facebook, and follow SPLC_org on Twitter. And if you're a student journalist or a journalism educator with any question about your rights, call our hotline at 703-807-1904 or email us at splc@splc.org. Thanks for listening.